One of the advantages of these parks is that it's a space where crucial resources are offered. These places are a focal point for serving knowledge-based companies producing advanced, specialized products needed in the domestic market. Science and technology parks also serve as a launching pad toward the international arena. We spoke with a park official who helped shed more light on this issue.
There are four scenarios of which foreign companies could have the opportunity to reside in Sanand Science and Technology Park. Well, the first scenario will be the execution of soft landing programs between the two countries, which gives the foreign companies an opportunity to get familiar with the host country's market. Well, the second scenario will be holding joint events, including joint startup events, fairs, and similar events, which could help them get familiar with each other. And the other scenario, or the third way that a company could have the chance to come to our park, will be to find and carry out joint projects with our companies, and finally sharing the interests. The fourth scenario will be holding joint innovation tours, which gives gives the companies an opportunity to get familiar with how innovation ideas are being implemented in other countries.
These parks are essential in filling a gap in the tech innovation ecosystem, providing monetary resources and attracting investments. These establishments also join investors with particular companies and projects. They offer numerous unique services such as facilitating visa processes, offering financial assistance such as soft loans or even special incentives under free trade zones like tax exemptions. And it doesn't stop there. This park offers so much more to investors.
The other solution or the other way that could attract foreign investors will be to define BOT models, which means they have to introduce projects and within the framework of our protocols. And once it has been approved, they can operate the project for a while. This includes mainly long-term projects. Particularly, and I shall have to tell you that Sanand Science and Technology Park is very interested in projects in the fields of artificial intelligence, IT, ICT, IoT, and virtual reality. And we could help these companies. And once they have, once they build it and then operate it, they could transfer it to our park.
Most tech parks are active in the international sphere and collaborate with other domestic tech parks. Furthermore, these areas function as export hubs. Therefore, one of their main activities is boosting and supplying domestic products to this end.
Sanand Science and Technology Park has been very active in international arena. And our president, Dr. Nazari, has put a great focus in this part. And for information, I have to tell you that we have held two prestigious international events at our park. One in our park, last year we did it in March, I think, with the presence of some great companies, a Turkish delegation, some companies from Turkey. And before that, we held a joint event with Paris Technology Park, which was a technology investment meeting, which we had brought another Turkish delegation to that event, and it was one of the first collaborations between science and technology parks of Iran with Paris Technology Park in such a big international event.
Over the years, the government has placed special attention on knowledge-based companies while implementing new approaches to support tech parks and their businesses. Some of these initiatives aim to remove obstacles along the path of development of these companies. Other activities involve giving resources to executive branches to further develop the ecosystem of innovation and technology nationwide. Along these lines, the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology has implemented a series of activities. This includes investing some $1.4 billion towards financial services. The government has also created a strategic technology development headquarters. It is tasked with implementing 400,000 tech projects and 150 commercialization projects. But that's not all. The government has also established 65 innovation centers and dozens more accelerators to support the developing entrepreneurship ecosystem. Currently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies scattered across the nation. These enterprises offer services and products in numerous industries. Many are active in biotech, computer software, agriculture, food, chemical tech, aircraft maintenance, steel, gas, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals, just to name a few. According to government figures, the knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. Moreover, the share of knowledge firms in the country's GDP in 2019 exceeded $34 billion and witnessed a 450% growth since then. That's all according to the Vice President for Science and Technology. All right, now it's time for me to take a little break here and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who's prepared a report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find the stress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company, that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in this area. that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reach the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is the phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's this whole thing, we call it desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, the linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So as you could see, it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen.
There is so much more that can be said about the country's knowledge-based production and activities. So before we go, let's look at a couple of developments in this area. Most of us are familiar with vitamin supplements. However, some vitamins need to be injected, which can be a hassle. Now, a knowledge-based company has produced an oral form of one of these vitamins, saving many of us from the pain of sticking needles. This pharmaceutical company has produced the first oral form of a vitamin B complex that was typically only found in an injectable form. This company also operates out of Pardis Science and Technology Park. It is also one of the first and largest knowledge-based companies. It might be interesting to know that this company mainly produces raw materials such as probiotic products needed in the pharma industry. Such productions have saved the country millions on imports so far. Knowledge-based productions are driven by scientific discoveries, and Iranian scientists produce roughly 2% of the world's scientific articles. That's according to the Minister of Science, Research and Technology. Mohammad Ali Zulfigol says Iran, on average, registers around 70,000 scientific articles in international journals each year. He says Iran is now globally ranked 15th for the number of scientific papers it produces. Zulfigol noted the quality ranking of Iranian articles in the top 10 fields like technology and engineering. The minister highlighted that the nation ranks 5th in nanotechnology publications as well. The official further added that those publishing academic articles also work in knowledge-based companies, helping produce quality products in the competitive field. And with that, we come to the end of this segment. You can contact us with your thoughts and comments via email. And don't forget, you can also send us topics you're interested in. Thank you for tuning in, and join us next week, same time, for another edition of Bazaar. It's bye for now. Until then.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
On World Water Day, the international community must not forget Palestinians living under Israeli regime occupation, whose access to clean water is severely restricted. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. According to Middle East Eye, the seizure of water to drive people from their land has long served as a tool of colonial domination. That process is well advanced in the occupied West Bank, where water has been controlled by the Zionist regime since its occupation began in 1967. While Arlicher 40 of the 1995 Oslo Second Interim Agreement between the Zionist regime and Palestinians set up a joint water committee. The Zionist regime retained veto power over all Palestinian water proposals, and no constraints were placed on the amount of water it could take from occupied Palestinian territory. In 2013, the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq analyzed the Zionist regime's discriminatory water practices as water apartheid. Its Water for One People Only report details how Israel's command of water resources in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip promotes the displacement of the Palestinian population and represents only one element of an irreversible structural process that can only be described as colonial. The Zionist regime's discriminatory water policies, which enable it to extract for its own use and that of its settlements some 90% of the water from the West Bank's mountain aquifer, and which deprive Palestinians of sufficient water for agriculture and their basic needs, are a focus of the two well-researched reports on Israeli apartheid produced in 2022 by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW. These reports join many others produced over the past two decades by Palestinian and Israeli organizations, UN bodies, the World Bank, NGOs, journalists, and scholars that describe how constraints imposed by military orders are steadily forcing Palestinian farmers from the 62% of the West Bank known as Area C. Farmers are prevented from drilling new wells or improving old ones, installing pumps, and even collecting rainwater, where their springs are seized and their water tanks, cisterns, and pipelines destroyed, while settlements and roads serving Eretz Israel are erected on their agricultural land. Israeli settlers consume six times the amount of water permitted to their Palestinian neighbors, who are forced to purchase expensive water extracted from the West Bank by Mekorot, the Israeli national water carrier, in order to overcome shortfalls in water allocation and frequent water shutoffs. The Zionist regime's weaponization of water for the benefit of settlers and de facto annexation can be regarded as a long-standing practice of settler colonialism. But how can one explain Israel's water policies in the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated places on Earth, where the Zionist regime evacuated its 21 settlements in 2005? Since then, Gazans have no longer experienced Israel's military occupation as the steady takeover of land. Instead, they have confronted an existential threat to their health and lives that Israeli historian Ilan Pepe, among others, has called incremental genocide. Some Israeli human rights lawyers firmly reject this application of the term, but water is life. And the impact of the Zionist regime's nearly 16-year-long blockade and five major military offensives on the severely limited clean water supply available for a rapidly growing population, half of them children, has raised questions about whether the Gaza Strip remains a livable place, to use the UN's phrase. The Israeli blockade has destroyed Gaza's economy and led HRW to refer to the Gaza Strip as an open-air prison. Its population is trapped within walls and fences and below constant drone surveillance, while the fabricated regime of Israel exerts tight control over all movement of goods and people by land and sea and from time to time engages in lethal mowing the grass military operations, but makes no attempt to reach a political solution. By 2021, half of the population of the impoverished Gaza Strip was unemployed. Gaza has only one source of renewable fresh water. The coastal aquifer, stretching from the northern occupied territories to the northern Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Along with the aquifers beneath the West Bank, the coastal aquifer has been under total Israeli control since the occupation began. According to a 2013 UN study, the Zionist regime extracts 66% of water of the coastal aquifer, while the Gaza Strip extracts 23% and Egypt 11%. The arrival in Gaza of hundreds of thousands of refugees from what is now called the fabricated regime of Israel put heavy pressure on the aquifer, and within decades, residents were extracting more water than could be replenished annually. In the period 1995 to 2011, water extraction increased more than 30%, causing a decline in the level of the aquifer that allowed sea water to leach in. The Zionist regime's deep wells, boreholes adjacent to Gaza, and dams have further impacted Gaza's water availability. The UN, in its August 2012 report, stated that the aquifer might be irreversibly damaged by 2020 without a 60% increase in Gaza's water supply. The World Bank cited an alarming and worsening situation in Gaza over the 2010-16 period and found that by 2016, access to improved drinking water in Gaza was close to zero. By 2020, Gazans were still getting over 95% of their water from the polluted aquifer and extracting three times its sustainable yield, with more than a third lost because of the decrepit infrastructure. Approximately 97% of that groundwater was unfit to drink due to high sewage and salinity levels. Gaza's remaining supply was produced by small, unregulated desalination plants, 2.6%, and 2% was purchased from the Israeli National Water Company, Mekorot, by the cash-strapped Palestinian Water Authority. An environmental assessment published in 2020 was particularly bleak. It found the coastal aquifer had been reduced to 10 meters below sea level. While only 55 to 60 million cubic meters could safely be taken from the aquifer, some 160 to 200 MEM were being extracted each year. Municipalities were only able to meet 80% of the residents' water needs, and pipe water failed to reach homes for days at a time. The shortage of clean water is only one part of the problem. The cost of purchasing often polluted trucked water is prohibitive for many Gazans, half of whom live below the poverty line. The water they consume is well below 100 liters per day standard for per capita domestic needs set by the World Health Organization. According to a press release issued by the Palestinian Bureau of Statistics and the Palestinian Water Authority on World Water Day, the daily per capita allocation of water for domestic use in Gaza is 86.6 liters per day. However, water suitable for human use amounts to only 26.8 liters daily. Mekorot puts Israeli per capita consumption of clean water at 230 liters per day. We'll be right back.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The political rift between the East and the West continues to broaden day after day. That can be clearly seen in the recent comments made by Russian President Vladimir Putin. In an interview with the Russian media, President Putin accused the United States and NATO of seeking to build a new global axis. Putin said the Union bore some resemblance to the World War II alliance between Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan. The Russian president also criticized Washington for its double standards and its own action in forming several military alliances. He named Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea as being in line to join what he termed as a global NATO.
They are announcing that they will create global NATO. What's that? Great Britain and Japan at the start of this year, in January, I think, have signed an agreement on developing relations and mutual development in military area.
The remarks by Putin come days after he and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping met in Moscow to discuss global developments. That created the idea for many in the Western world that the two powers are seeking to form a military alliance.
It does not correspond with reality at all. We are not creating any military alliance with China. Yes, we have cooperation in the sphere of military technical interaction. We are not hiding this. Everything is transparent. There is nothing secret. We have military cooperation. We conduct drills not only with China, but even with other countries as well.
In a statement following their Moscow summit, the two leaders said their relations are not bloc-like, confrontational, or directed at third countries. The statement comes as Washington has recently said that it fears Beijing could arm Russia in its war with Ukraine. Moscow, however, has time and again reiterated that its stance in Ukraine is defensive in nature against the aggressive West. This is why Russia has pointed its fingers at the West for funneling billions of dollars worth of ammunition to Ukraine. Moscow argues that the help from the Western alliance to Kiev does pose a threat to its national security. Putin, however, has assured that Russia will not be outgunned in the war despite all the Western interference. Putin's remarks come at a time when China and Russia already share a common concern of encirclement by the United States and NATO. Many say Russia sees NATO's eastward expansion as an existential threat, which according to them has been the main reason for its war with Ukraine. In West Asia, the United States maintains its presence in countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But the reality on the ground indicates that Washington is only after plundering their natural riches. Washington's presence in the West Asia region also serves as a goal to maintain its encirclement of Russia. In East Asia, China is concerned that the United States is trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From its military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan, it seems that Putin's assessment about Western powers recruiting allies from across the world to create an axis is closer to the reality. That can be significantly highlighted after NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg paid a visit to Japan and South Korea, where he stressed the Atlantic Alliance working closely with partners in the Indo-Pacific region. He also urged the nations to support Ukraine with more military support. Quite contrary, China has recently helped broker a diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia after a seven-year break and announced its decision to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. This not only shows there is no West-like military alliance between Washington and Beijing, but also indicates that countries in the East are seeking a peaceful resolution to the world's crises unless their national security is threatened. From a different perspective, an alliance between America's two greatest strategic and military foes would not be as bad, given that there is high potentiality to shift the global order.
March 26th marks the 8th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen, a conflict which started after Riyadh, leading a coalition of 9 countries from West Asia and North Africa, launched an intervention to reinstate Saudi-backed former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi after he was ousted by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. According to UN figures, the war has so far claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people and brought the country's vital infrastructure to the brink of collapse. The war has also displaced millions of people. Riyadh and its allies also imposed a crippling blockade on Yemen, which has consequently caused a dire humanitarian crisis, with millions of children suffering from malnutrition and diseases like cholera. In a recent report, the United Nations expressed concern that it could be forced to slash support for children in Yemen without a funding boost. The UN Children's Agency said more than 540,000 under the age of 5 are suffering life-threatening severe acute malnutrition, with one child continuing to die every 10 minutes from preventable causes. UNICEF said if funding is not received, the agency might be forced to scale down its vital assistance, adding that the children of Yemen should be able to look to the future with hope, not fear. Peter Hawkins, UNICEF's representative in Yemen, said we called on all parties to help us deliver that hope by committing to the Yemeni people and pulling a country and a weary population back from the brink. But given all the sufferings by the Yemeni people, the war has stopped well shy of all its goals, despite killing hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turning Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Not only the war has not stopped, but the West's all-out support for Saudi Arabia has even exacerbated the situation and diminished prospects for peace. While Saudi Arabia maintains its blockade on Yemen, the humanitarian situation there is deteriorating day after day. This comes in light of the silence of the international community in dealing with the human catastrophe there. The current situation in Yemen questions the role of world countries in bringing the years-long deadly conflict to an end. Some countries have made efforts to help decrease the sufferings of the Yemeni people by sending humanitarian aid to the war-torn country or facilitate intra-Yemen talks to end the conflict. However, a sustainable political settlement in Yemen requires a more comprehensive approach. With the United Nations working with Yemeni parties and also regional and international stakeholders, there are hopes that the devastating conflict could soon be over. As long as a ceasefire is concerned, although a truce agreed between warring sides in April 2022 has largely been held, the UN Secretary-General's Special Envoy for Yemen says the military situation in Yemen is fragile. Hans Grundberg says the truce can only be a stepping stone, adding that the UN urgently needs to build on what was achieved by the truce and work towards a nationwide ceasefire and an inclusive political settlement to end the conflict in Yemen. Grundberg says now that Iran and Saudi Arabia have finally clinched an agreement to restore diplomatic relations and reopen embassies and missions, the warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take the decisive steps towards peace. He says momentum to end the conflict in Yemen has been renewed by a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume ties. This can be clearly highlighted in comments made by Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who has numerously reaffirmed Tehran's support for any dialogue which would help promote peace and stability in Yemen. The top diplomat says the Islamic Republic supports intra-Yemeni talks to find a political solution to the crisis in the war-wracked Arab country. Even former Saudi officials have expressed optimism that the agreement between Tehran and Riyadh will be a game-changer for West Asia. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is that ending the years-long Yemen conflict requires patience, long-term perspective, courage, and leadership. According to the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, much has been achieved over the past year, and now it is time to take the next step.
France is in a crisis mode. Police have clashed with protesters angry at President Macron's controversial pension reforms. Unions claim 3.5 million people turned out across the country, while authorities suggested the figure was much lower at just under 1.1 million. In the capital, Paris, union leaders said that a record 800,000 people took part in the march throughout the city to demand that the government drop the fiercely contested change. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said dozens of police officers had been injured and dozens of people were arrested across the country. Earlier, workers blocked access to a terminal at the Charles de Gaulle Airport, forcing some travelers to get there on foot. French trade unions have called for fresh nationwide strikes and protests amid growing anger over the government's unpopular pension reforms. Trade unions have blamed the government for, quote, the explosive situation in the country. They also asked workers to continue protesting against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms.
For us, 10, 12 years ago, the previous pension reform was already unacceptable. What we want is a retirement age at 60 years old and 55 years old for those with hard-working conditions. And at one point, all these demands have to be expressed on the ground. And if we have to go beyond the demands set by the inter-unions, then this is what we will do.
Train and air travel was disrupted, while teachers were among many professions to walk off the job. Plumes of smoke were seen rising from burning piles of debris, blocking traffic on a highway near Toulouse in southwestern France. And strikes briefly blocked roads in other cities as well. Police also fired tear gas at some protesters in several other cities and used water cannon against others in Rennes in the northwest. Protests against the measures have raged since January.
The only thing he could say to appease the anger would be that he renounces reform, that there won't be any reform, that he respects the fact that the vast majority of the people don't want it, and that he regrets the way it happened. It most probably won't be that way, so I think we are in a deep crisis that will linger on for weeks and maybe months.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has said the legislation, which his government pushed through the French Parliament without a vote last week, would come into force by year-end, despite escalating tensions. The protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago.
We may be at the beginning of a new Gilets Jaunes Yellow Vest movement, absolutely, because there is no democratic way out. The only thing that could avoid that would be a decision by the Supreme Court, the French Supreme Court, to overrule the law and to, you know, reset the legislative process. It has the power to do this. This is the only hope we have to avoid a major crisis.
Opinion polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote. Since December, Macron has suffered a substantial drop of 8 points, and he now sees only 28% satisfied and 70% dissatisfied. Macron's government has shunned Parliament to impose the unpopular pension reforms via a special constitutional power, the so-called Article 49.3, which provides that the government can pass a bill without a vote at the National Assembly, the lower house of Parliament, after a deliberation at a cabinet meeting.
I think it's a déni de démocratie.
I think this was a denial of democracy. The government passed a law for which a majority of French people were against. The National Assembly was against it, using the 49.3 as a scornful of French public opinion. Macron was elected with no majority. He was elected against the Front National. We did not give him a mandate to pass these reforms, which are unjust.
Procedure has been used in the past by various governments, but this time it's prompting a lot of criticism because of the massive public opposition to the proposed reform. The proposed changes include raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increasing the number of years people must make contributions to receive a full state pension. The reforms were at the heart of President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. The government insists the reform plan is essential to ensure the French pension system does not run out of money.
So yes, there aren't 100 solutions if we want the pension system to be balanced. It no longer is. And the more we wait, the more it will get worse. And so this reform is necessary. And I say this to the French people, I don't enjoy doing this, I would have preferred not to do this, but it's also because of a sense of responsibility that I express my commitment to do this in front of you.
But many see the changes, such as raising the retirement age, as unfair to people who started working young.
I'm already disadvantaged in terms of my quarterly periods, given my redundancy, given the retirement age, which is being pushed back again and again. I've had a very, very long career. I started at 15, and I feel like I'll never get there.
Last September, three explosions targeted the Nord Stream 1 and 2 natural gas pipelines. The blast rendered three of the four lines inoperable and released vast quantities of methane into the Baltic Sea. None of the four pipes are currently operational, bringing the Nord Stream project to an effective standstill. Back then, there were speculations the U.S. may have carried out the sabotage attack. Back then, former Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski thanked the U.S. for damaging the Nord Stream gas pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again. Then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly? Since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control.
We will. I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
But in February 2023. U.S. investigative journalist Seymour Hersh alleged that the blasts were carried out by the U.S. in a top-secret CIA operation ordered by President Joe Biden, with the collaboration from Norway. Hersh claimed that the U.S. Navy divers operating from a Norwegian ship, using NATO's exercise in June 2022 as cover, had planted mines which were later remotely detonated by a sonar bio dropped from a Norwegian plane.
They set up a committee to think of options. Russia was clearly going to go. The threat the president had yet to make had not been made. And this is December before New Year's Day of the year before, 2021. And the question inside the committee, and it included the usual CIA, NSA, Treasury Department, State Department, you name it. And they met in the secret office building in the across the street from the White House in the executive office building. The option was, do you want us to do something kinetic or something not kinetic? In other words, not kinetic would be more sanctions, or something kinetic would be, you know, taking out the pipeline, as had been thought about.
Following Hearst's revelation, news emerged in several media outlets, including the New York Times and the German newspaper Der Zeit, that pro-Ukrainian group carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines last year. But Hersh now says the CIA was instructed to come up with a cover story for the Nord Stream bombings that was fed to media outlets. Hersh says the cover-up story was created to shift blame from the U.S. Hersh says the CIA was ordered to come up with a cover story after President Biden met with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Washington on March 3.
Seymour Hersh, journalist who has been covering this extensively, says this is exactly what happened, that indeed the CIA and German intelligence created this whole hogwash cover story and handed it to the media, double-spaced, you know, just exactly what they wanted you to ingest, and that the media ran with it.
Over a year has passed since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Since the war began, the U.S. and its Western allies rushed to Ukraine's help and armed it with various types of weapons. They are now inextricably involved in the outcome of the war. In 2022, the U.S. led the way with major support decisions for Ukraine, with EU countries following suit. According to the Institute for the World Economy, adding pledges of nearly 37 billion euros in December, the Americans have earmarked a total of just over 73.1 billion euros for Ukraine's support. For the EU, the comparable figure is 54.9 billion euros. Based on estimates, the ammunition sought by Kiev could cost the bloc some 825 million euros for just 1 month. There are talks of the delivery of depleted uranium to Ukraine. Russia has already warned against such escalations. A report by the World Bank said that it will cost Ukraine $411 billion over the next 10 years to recover and rebuild from the war. Apart from Ukraine, Europe has also been forced to foot the bill. The economy of Europe is also suffering immensely. The European Union's industry chief has said the bloc will have to shift to a wartime economic model if it hopes to meet Kiev's battlefield needs. Europe's heavyweights like Germany are suffering economically. The war and the growing energy prices have cost the German economy about 2.5% of its GDP.
Faced with new and overlapping shocks, we have no choice today but to deal with uncertainty. But the public can be certain about one thing. We will deliver price stability, and bringing inflation back to 2% over the medium term is not negotiable.
While the impact is milder than expected, the country still faces a minor recession. The Biden administration is luring European companies, including German businesses. According to the German-American Chamber of Commerce, around 5,600 of them have invested in the U.S. market as of September 2022. That's an investment volume of almost $650 billion. So the question is, why is Europe risking its economic independence for the benefit of the United States and its businesses?
This was a premeditated terrorist attack on European critical infrastructure. It was also environmental terrorism. Does the EU care? Do you need to know who did it, or do you want to know? Hirsch says the U.S. did it. Did you ask him? Did you ask him, did he do it? Or did he ask them questions anymore? Have we become so subservient? Has the EU become so subservient to US empire that you can't even ask them if they did it?
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Once the Prophet's 16th fallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, was asked as which of these two people is better, the one who reads more Quran in his ritual prayer or the other one who reads more supplication in his ritual prayer, while both of them finish the prayer together. The Imam said that both are good. But when he was asked again, he said that supplication is better. And three times swore by God that supplication is the best worship. Dear listeners, let us not neglect supplication in this blessed month. Once a man came to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and opened a parcel in which there was a bird with its chicks. The Bedouin said, "While I was passing through the desert, I found these chicks and took them thinking that they may die of hunger in this desert. On the way, a bird kept flying over our head. I realized that it was the mother. So, as soon as I opened the parcel, it came down as it couldn't tolerate separation from its chicks." The Prophet of Islam said, "The merciful God is 1,000 times kinder to his servants than this bird to its chicks." Elsewhere, the Prophet said, "God's mercy is 100 parts, which he has manifested only one part of it in this world, and the rest will be manifested on the judgment day." May God help us recognize him like those true believers as they find the remaining 99 parts and believe in them in this world. Hence, they try not to even think of sins. Imam Reza, peace upon him, says, "Have a good opinion of God because God says, 'I am with your opinion.' If your opinion is good, my behavior will also be good. But if your opinion is evil, my behavior will also be evil." As a matter of fact, having evil opinion of God and being suspicious of him is the sign of feeble faith. That's why the Prophet says, "When you call Allah, be certain that it will be heard." This certainty is optimism and positive opinion on God, which will cause the prayer to be heard. Being optimistic of God does not mean to be engaged in sins with the illusion that God will forgive us. Rather, while being optimistic of God, we should always be pessimistic of ourselves, because our inner self incessantly invites to evil and sins. In many supplications that are the heritage of the Prophet and the infallible Imams of his Ahlul Bayt, we are taught to be optimistic of Allah. Being optimistic of God while fearing the sins and confessing them shamefully will cause us not to repeat them. In the nights of the blessed month of Ramadan, we read in Dua Iftitah, which is supplication of opening or starting, "O Allah, indeed your excusing towards my sin and your overlooking towards my flaw and your pardoning towards my wrongdoing and your covering towards my evil deed and your forbearing towards much of my crimes have made me greedy of asking you what I do not deserve from what you have bestowed upon me of your mercy and showed me of your power, and caused me to know of your hearing. So all these caused me to call you in serenity with no fear or horror. Pardoning and excusing are among Allah's attributes. They are mentioned in the Quran 34 times. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in his famous sermon, while introducing the blessed month of Ramadan, that Allah's month has come with blessing, mercy, and forgiveness. Each of these words is a manifestation of God's kindness and attention to his servants. Generally speaking, God's affairs are all done in the universe through his mercy and favor. He does not expose the sins and evil characteristics of his servants, in spite of being aware of all of them. Servants commit sin, but